Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Bill Moyers is our guest this hour. He has a wonderful book that's conversations continuing from his journal. It's about 47 or 48 conversations with people like John Stewart, Robert Bly, Jeremy Scahill, Sarah Lawrence Lightfoot, Jane Goodall, Maxine Hong Kingston, Wendell Potter, Nell Painter, Victor Gold, and the list goes on. And these aren't just conversations. These are conversations about where we are, the common good, if there is a common good, poetry. The book is filled with poetry because Bill loves poetry. And it also can make our hearts sing or point to, in very important ways, that which ails us. Bill, of course, has been with public television for a long, long time. For those of you who don't know a whole lot about him, he was a founding organizer of the Peace Corps. He was a senior White House assistant and press secretary to President Lyndon Johnson from 63 to 67, the publisher of Newsday, senior news analyst for CBS News, the producer of groundbreaking series for public television. He has won more than 30 Emmy Awards and 9 Peabody Awards, and he's written a number of best-selling books, including Listening to America, A World of Ideas, and The Power of Myth, which he wrote with Joseph Campbell. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Bill Moyers. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and our email address is talk@wpr.org, and I'm sure we'll have plenty of phone calls, so get your calls in early. Hello, Bill Moyers.
Hi there. How are you out in Wisconsin?
We're okay out in Wisconsin. Well, you know, things are always going on in Wisconsin these days.
Everything but doubled.
I know. It's just incredible. It's one story after
another. But you would expect that if you know, all of you who know something about Wisconsin's history, it's always been a battleground for democracy, a laboratory for progressive ideas and the opposition to them. So that's what you've got going on there.
That's right. Bob La Follette and Joseph McCarthy.
Robert La Follette said democracy is a daily struggle, and mm-hmm. it is. You can't ever take it for granted.
Ain't that the truth? I really loved your book, and I loved it because these conversations are just so darned meaty, aren't they? You must have finished them and thought, oh, I got to go read some more poetry, or I really want to learn more about, not that you didn't already know this, but I want to delve again into Civil War and slavery. They're just meaty.
I've long said, it's almost become a cliche with my family and friends now, that journalism is a continuing course in adult education.
Yes.
My own. And so I get to talk to these interesting people and go to these fascinating places and put it together for myself. And then through public television, I'm fortunate to have a classroom to share it with everybody else or anybody who wants to sign up.
I love the little piece that I didn't know this about you, teachers, the role of teachers. It's amazing, isn't it? You had a star role in a high school play. Where was this? And your teacher, after the director, I think, afterwards said, Bill, maybe you should go into journalism.
That was Julia Garrett. That's a true story. But Selma Brutzi was my English teacher, and she ran a portrait contest in which I submitted the only poem I've ever written in my life, and after it was over, she said to me, I think you should go into journalism. So there went the stage, and there went poetry.
But the book is filled with poetry. I love it, and you had so many of these people read poems on the air to you. Poetry is important.
It is. There's a lot of politics and economics, as usual, in the book, and money and politics, the power of corporations over our democracy, but you can't live only in the world of politics and economics without something happening to your soul, to your spirit. So from time to time in my career over the last 40 years, and particularly in this series, I have gone to where the spirit dwells. I have gone to the poets who inspire it, to Robert Bly from Minnesota, who brings that brooding Norwegian sensibility to modern American culture. I've gone to W.S. Merwin. One of my favorite interviews in the book is with the present poet laureate. He was then, W.S. Merwin. And,
uh-huh.
I once went with Maya Angelou to where she grew up in Texas, Stamps, Arkansas, and we were walking through the dusty streets of that that dilapidated southern town, and she was telling me about a woman, her teacher named Mrs. Flowers, and she said Mrs. Flowers taught us that poetry is music written for the human ear. And of course, it's true. When you hear a poet, I particularly like to hear poets read their works more so than I like to hear other people read poetry, because the poets understand that they wrote the music. They're inside the cadence and the rhythm of it. So there's a lot of poetry in the book as well.
Nikki Giovanni, I was glad you included her.
She has come along on a long journey, hasn't she?
Yes, she has. I do, too. I remember her.
Yeah, in the 60s, she was called the Black Princess. And here she is teaching English at Virginia Tech. And the young man who has been accused and who did kill the students down there in that rampage was in her class. She was actually away from the campus at the time, but she came hurrying back. And when she heard the description of the assailant, she knew that it was that young man. So when the memorial service was held for the victims, she was asked to speak. She said it was the hardest thing she has ever done. But they gave her their eyes were wet with tears, but they gave her a standing ovation when she finished that short talk at the memorial service. And you'll find that interview with her and the poems she read in the book.
I love the interview with John Lithgow, and you had seen Arthur Miller's All My Sons. I guess he gave a spectacular performance, but he his work is informed, really, and his life is informed by Shakespeare and other poets.
His father directed the Shakespearean Theater at the University in Ohio, and then I think he helped set up the Shakespearean Theater in one of the large cities in Ohio. So John Lithgow, who actually lives in the building where I live in New York City, grew up with Shakespeare in his head and poetry, too. He loves the sonnets of Shakespeare. He has that great voice that can bring a Shakespearean sonnet right into the moment. And I ran into him on the street one day. He just was publishing a book of his favorite poems, and told me what some of them were, and I just intuitively, instantly said, come on the show in a couple of weeks, John. And I had just seen him in Arthur Miller's All My Sons, which was such a moving and powerful revival of that Miller classic. I think it's really I like it better. I love, of course, Death of a Salesman, because it goes to the tragedy of capitalism, the individual who doesn't make it and is cast aside. But this one is about All My Sons is about a father who discovers that his father was a crook during the war, selling defective parts to the Air Force and causing the death of several young pilots. And the whole tension is between the father and the son. And Lithgow was playing the father there, and you just get this wonderful performance that is so informed by his understanding of the tragedy. Of the tragic poets. So that interview also is in the book and is, as you just said, one that resonates even today.
It sure does. I just saw Death of a Salesman from the Milwaukee Rep a couple months ago.
Yeah.
Wonderful performance. And Arthur Miller resonates today in so many ways. Let's talk about, because there are a lot of interviews, be they with economists, people who are looking at what's going on with the haves and the have-nots right now, but you spend, and thank God you do, for a lot of time on this. There are some statistics that I'm sure stood out for you as they did for me. I was speaking with my son, who has a minimum wage job this summer. He's a college student. He was figuring out how low his paycheck was. And who is the interview with where it said you would need 6 minimum wage jobs for a husband and wife in order to barely make ends meet, but then you'd have to go to the food bank to get your food?
I believe that's Holly Sklar.
Yes,
who is very active in the field of equality and income inequality. And I think that's her figure. Yes, the difference between the top and the bottom in terms of income today is greater than it's been since the Great Depression, the 1930, 1931, 1932. I grew up in the period just after, during and right after World War II, when that post-war economy and our agreement on the social contract produced a period of growing prosperity in which workers shared, starting with about late 1970s and early in the 80s in particular. The economy kept growing, but the prosperity was not shared with the workers, even though they were more productive than ever. That the economy grew because of the increased productivity of American workers. But despite that productivity, American workers did not share in that prosperity. And by and large, the incomes of working people today have been stagnant. They were stagnant in the 80s and 90s. They increased a little bit in the late 90s. And since 2000, they have been fairly stagnant again. So it means that the economy keeps increasing its wealth, but that wealth is not being shared with the people who really produce it. In Abraham Lincoln's great address of, I believe, 1861, he talks about how labor precedes capital, that without labor, capital cannot do its work. And he believed very much in the right to rise. So did the Republican Party during and right after the Civil War. The right to rise of every citizen to have a chance to gain the dignity and security of a middle-class livelihood. That was the American dream, and that's what brought so many millions of immigrants here. But today, the American dream is stagnant because workers' income is not increasing, and it takes, as Holly Sklar said, far more effort and more than one job to just make ends meet, and then you still are running to stay up.
Yeah. James Galbraith is in the book as well, and let's spend a little bit of time talking about this. He says that we've come through a generation where we really denied the existence of a common good or a public purpose. I think we've recognized that the path leads to collapse, the collapse that we've seen. Do you agree with that? We don't have much of a common purpose right now?
I agree with that. I grew up, as I said, in the World War, in the 40s and 50s. My father was poor. My dad never made over $100 a week in his life, and he only did that in the last 7 years of his life. I still have the paycheck from his final, the stub from his final paycheck, and after taxes it came to $96 and some odd cents. That means he made just a little over $100 that last week of his life. But even though I was from one of the poorest families in town, a little town of 20,000 in East Texas, Marshall, Texas, I went to school with the daughter of the richest man in town. Richard Blaylock was a very successful entrepreneur, and he was wealthy comparatively to everybody else in town. His daughter, Ann, went to the same school system I did. But even though I came from the poorest town, I was able to go to good public schools, avail myself of a public park, use the public library and the public highways and other public facilities. When I went off to college, I drove down a public highway to a great public university, the University of Texas. I used the public library there. I was as rich in public goods as Ann Blaylock was. And I have been grateful all of my life to the people I never met who had built those facilities, the highways, the libraries, the university before I came along. That was part of the American social contract, that even the rich would be taxed to pay for facilities that the poor didn't have, because living in a society where more people have access to good schools, good libraries, good public parks, good facilities is better than living in a society where you have to build a wall around your community and isolate yourself because the conditions in the rest of the country where you live are horrendous. And we have lost that. It's actually contained in the most beautiful, to me, the most beautiful passage of American prose, the preamble to the Constitution, often overlooked when people talk about the Constitution. We, the people, in order to form a more perfect union, not in order to get rich in a republic of money, not in order to accumulate more than anybody else, but we, in order to form a more perfect union. And, you know, here's when I talk this way, the Wall Street Journal and others say, oh, class war, Warriors wants to have a class war. Well, we've had a class war for the last 30 years, a 30-year war in which the powers that be have preempted the wealthy interests of this country, in particular the correspondent, the corporations, have bought off the Republican Party and bought off a half of the Democratic Party. And you'll find in the book a marvelous interview, not side by side with James K. Galbraith, with Simon Johnson, one of the brightest young economists around. And he talks about how Americans don't like this term, but we have an oligarchy in America today. And that means economic power assembled from political power that is derived from economic power from wealth, whose purpose is to protect wealth and to enhance that economic. That's what we have. We have a society grossly divided today between the haves and the have-nots. And that is a not only an injury to the American dream, it is almost a mortal wound. I sometimes despair because I see what's happening in our country now. But when we're charged with class warfare, let me just say this. It is, I believe the rich, and all of your listeners who are rich should really pay attention to this. I believe the rich have the right to buy more homes, more vacations, more cars, more gizmos, so on. They do not have the right to buy more democracy. And that's what has happened in America today. The wealthy, organized economic interests are buying our political system right out from under us, lock, stock, and barrel.
When it should be, as another Texan says in the book, his progressive view, actually it was his father's, Jim Hightower, when we should know that everybody does better when everybody does better.
That's right. That's right. And I come back to what La Follette, the great Republican progressive of a century ago, said, that democracy is a way of life that involves a daily struggle. And that's what all of the conversations in this book underscore. I think they're nourishment for the everyday battles we fight for a just society. People say, well, what are we going to do about it? Well, the answer is we have to fight back. I mean, I said to a friend of mine on Wall Street, how do you feel about the market? And he said, well, I'm optimistic. I said, then why do you look so worried? And he said, because I'm not sure my optimism is justified.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not either. I'm not sure my optimism about our country is justified. But I don't know what the alternative is but to fight back, as many people have been doing out there and all over the country. Every night when I turn off my computer and every morning when I turn it on, I look at the five pictures right there. Henry 18, Thomas 17, his birthday is today, my second grandson. Nancy, who's 14, Jassy, who's 10, and Sarah, my youngest granddaughter, who's 7. They don't have a representative. They don't have a lobbyist in Washington. They don't even have a vote. They got their grandfather.
Mm-hmm.
And all you know, that's what we all have to think about, is the reciprocity that we owe the next generation, because look at what the generation above us did for us with those public facilities, those public schools, those public highways, those public universities. And if we take them for granted or we give up, then the next generation will be at a significant loss.
Well, they're lucky they got their grandpa, right?
You're very kind.
They are. Let's welcome phone calls. Bill Moyers is our guest this hour. His Bill Moyers Journal, The Conversation Continues, has recently been published and includes some 47 or 48 interviews with various people who are on the show. And these are deep thinkers. These are people worth reading about. And I love the format, because the things that they make you want to think about are front and center, and the questions are good from Bill, and it makes you go, the best of reading, I think. For me, I always go to something else after I've read a bit of this, and this gets you thinking about history and poetry and Shakespeare and common purpose and all of that. It's good. So we'll be with you in a moment. Our phone lines are busy, but keep trying. There will be an opening. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We start our phone calls for Bill Moyers with Marie in Bayview. Hi, Marie.
Hi there. I just had to call because I wanted to speak to Mr. Moyers because it's a great honor. It's a great honor to speak to Mr. Moyers. Mr. Moyers, I would like to say that I T-vote a lot of your programs, and I can't erase them. Because whenever I think I'm down in the dumps and thinking, well, what's going on and where are we going and what are we going to do about it, I can watch a Bill Moyers show and get an answer maybe of what I should be looking toward and how I could get there.
Well, that's very kind of you, Marie. I appreciate it. I don't have the answers. I discovered when I went to graduate school that graduate school was where I got my questions answered. And then I graduated, and life became where I had my question, my answers questioned. And so I guess that's one reason I'm a journalist, is I have a lot of questions and not many answers. But I was saying earlier in the broadcast that I look at the pictures of my five grandchildren, and I think this infuses my work. I practice the philosophy of the Italian political scientist Gramsci. He said he practiced the pessimism of the mind. That is, you see the world as it is. And I think that's what we journalists owe you, listeners and readers and viewers. We owe you a view without illusions of what's happening in the world. But then he went on to say, although I practice the pessimism of the mind, I practice the optimism of the will. He said, because I couldn't live in the world as it is without trying to imagine a more confident future and then getting up every morning to do something to try to bring it about. And I try to report on and interview people and do essays on how we can try to make a difference. I mean, interview you will enjoy in the book is with the late historian Howard Zinn.
Yes.
You may remember he wrote that wonderful, powerful, popular book called The People's History of the United States. And just a few weeks before his death, he came on my show, and what I remember most from a scintillating interview was he said, don't depend on our leaders to do what needs to be done, because whenever the government has done anything to bring about change, it's done so only because it's been pushed and prodded by social movements from ordinary people. You know, people agitate, they demonstrate, they petition, they push, they stand up for themselves and with each other, and that's how we, ordinary people, make history. So I think that attitude does, in fact, inform my work, so that I can't just leave you wringing your hands in despair and desperation. I hope that you think all through what you've just heard and resolve for yourself how, where you live out there in Wisconsin or wherever you're calling from, you can do something today to make a difference.
Yeah, thanks for the call. I'm so glad, talking about somebody who can make a difference, I'm so glad because he's a local boy, and I think of him as a kid because he's much younger than I am and he's done extraordinary things. I'm so glad you include Jeremy Scahill, who's doing incredible investigative work. Isn't he? He's just a marvel.
He truly is one of those independent journalists without whom we would be at the total mercy of the corporate media. And Jeremy Scahill came out of a background, I believe it was the Dorothy Day's Christian social workers movement. And he has this strong sense of conscience that informs his work. He did this incredible book about Blackwater, the mercenary firm that hires itself out to the U.S. government and others to do to fight wars and the like, and you talk about the relevance of these interviews. I interviewed him the first time about 4 years ago, and just recently about Blackwater and the more than 630 companies hired by the U.S. to help implement the occupation of Iraq. And just the other day, there's a story about Blackwater being back in the news because they're organizing mercenary forces for some of the dictators or the strong rulers of the Middle East. So this interview done, you go back and read it today, it's as if I just did it earlier this week. But this is a big problem, of course. We're outsourcing our wars. So the cost of them are hidden from people, and the consequences of them are also difficult to ascertain and monitor. But Jeremy Scahill is just one of those independent voices without whom we would be even in more desperate trouble. I once asked the historian and journalist Richard Reeves, a student asked the historian and journalist Richard Reeves, what's your definition of real news? And Dick Reeves answered, news we need to keep our freedoms. And that's the kind of news that draws a Jeremy Scahill. My mentor in journalism at the University of Texas once said to us, to the class, news is what people want to keep hidden. Everything else is publicity. And too many journalists spend their time chasing the publicity that people want instead of finding the news that people want to keep hidden. And Jeremy Scahill walks around metaphorically with a great shovel in his hand because he just keeps digging.
He sure does. He's quite a person. Karen in Rolling Stone, Minnesota. Hi, Karen.
Oh, good morning. Mr. Moyers, hearing your voice on the radio reminds me of how much my husband and I miss you on television.
Oh, well, I miss all of you, too. You know, you can't, like Kathleen, you can't see the audience, but I know she, on radio, experiences what I experienced on television, the felt presence of the audience. I mean, I was looking into an inanimate object, the black lens of a camera, and of course I couldn't see anybody behind, on the other side, but I knew you were there, and I had this sense of your presence, almost as if there were a campfire out there, and people came in from the dark to sit around it and not feel so alone anymore.
Well, that's exactly what it felt like to us. Friday night for many years has been my husband's and my date night, and we begin with watching Jim Lehrer and the PBS News, and then we would watch, when we lived in Wisconsin, we would watch the Wisconsin News, and we would watch Gwen Ifill with Washington Week, which we still do, but all of it was a lead-up to watching you.
Well, just try to think, Karen, of what it would be like out there if Kathleen were on the air, and if Friday night went dark on that television screen with PBS on it, you would be alone in ways that would be frightening. I think public television, public radio, for all of our flaws, are still the only media in the country. Broadcast media, free of commercials and free of commercial values. I think Kathleen in her broadcast looks out and knows she's got an audience of citizens there, not consumers. She's not trying to sell you something. She's trying to help you inform yourself. That's what I felt. I never felt that the people who were out around that campfire on a Friday night were consumers looking for me to sell them something. They had come because they are citizens who care about the life of this country.
And also, you have to think about all of the voices who we wouldn't hear, all of the people in your book who, my goodness, you want to listen to these people, don't you, Bill? They have so many important things to say, historic, what our national purpose is, what's happening with rich and poor, what's our history. Those voices have to be heard, and actually they're just being heard on places like public television and public radio. I feel like we're in a pledge drive.
Well, I consider myself always in a pledge drive,
right,
when I'm on any public radio or public television, because we are the public. But I don't mean that as a cliche. This is your radio station. Wisconsin Public Radio is yours. PBS is yours. And if we're not trying to find those voices that help you engage in what I call the conversation of democracy, then we're failing our mission.
Yeah.
And a pledge, please. It's not pledge time. But
no, it's not. But you can pledge anyhow. You can pledge anytime. Karen, thank you. I'm sure you'll think of Friday night date night in a totally different way now, Bill, that you were the date night. Isn't that something? Marty from Milwaukee is next. Hi, Marty.
Hey, hello, Kathleen and Mr. Moyers. This is a real treat. It's funny, I lived in Houston, Texas in the mid-70s for a few years, and so I have some memory of sort of the last inklings of Texas progressivism, and I guess you're sort of one of those representatives. There are not too many of them left, are they?
Not too many, actually. And by the way, you'll be interested in knowing I'm going down in November and speak to the big progressive forum there. I say big, I think there'll be three people present.
Oh, Bill, not if you're there.
No, the strong community of progressives, a vital community. I was just teasing. Texas is, of course, has been taken over by the corporate right, the political and corporate right, and Governor Bob Perry, who some couple of years ago talked about seceding from the union, is thinking about running for president. He's a second George Bush, and he actually makes George Bush look like Theodore Roosevelt in comparison in terms of his political views. But, Marty, you're from Milwaukee. I don't know if you remember or not, but I spent, my team and I, over the 10 years of the 90s, we spent a lot of time in Milwaukee looking at two families, an African-American family and a white family, yeah, whose breadwinners had lost their good-paying jobs, yes, in manufacturing there. And we called the series. We did four broadcasts about them over the 10 years called Surviving the Good Times, because they had slipped from good paying jobs into just paycheck to paycheck, and they were surviving with nobility, but they were having a very hard time. And that's when it first began to hit me that one of the themes of this book is how America is dividing between winners and losers with little sympathy for the latter.
That's the question I wanted to bring up, if I could, for just a second. I share your pessimism, but we do have some American history to look back at, and it seems as though when the pain finally gets great enough, democracy speaks. And again, I'm thinking of the 1930s, and all of a sudden the mindset changes. I guess I'm wondering, what would you see that's different this time around? Because, of course, there were all kinds of issues with media, and everything seemed to be in the hands of the wealthy in the 20s and in the Gilded Age, and yet somehow this nation has been able to restore itself. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, the boom and bust cycle of capitalism has been repeating itself over and over since the Civil War. The Great Depression of 1877, the Depression of 1893. It takes calamity, it seems, to bring us to our senses. The only answer to organized money is organized people, and we don't tend to get organized until it's almost too late. You're right, Marty, it takes a long time. It took 250 years to abolish slavery, and then it took a bloody civil war before it was actually eliminated. Then it took another 100 years before what should have been the fruits of freedom won by that war for African Americans was realized in the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s. Look how long it took women to gain the right to vote, and only after they went to jail, they marched, they were mistreated, they were ridiculed, they were rebuffed. Finally, they did. Look how long it took workers to win the right to organize, a right that is now being slowly but more swiftly dismantled today. Yet, what's different between now and the past are two things, it seems to me. The rich have more wealth than they've ever had, and they use that wealth to buy off the political system. Secondly, we have wall-to-wall propaganda disguised, Republican propaganda disguised as news, whether it's Fox News or talk radio. You have wall-to-wall fact-free zone, so that it's very hard for people to, if the corporate media, mainstream media falls down in telling, reporting the reality, it's harder and harder for people out there to know what is in fact happening in the country. I still believe, as Howard Zinn said, that we have the capacity to organize, we have the capacity to act and to make history, and that's my hope. That's why I don't go to bed pessimistic every night.
Thanks very much for the call. I can't remember who it was in the book talked about Well, lots of people talked about the current president, but looking at him with great promise and with hope that we were going to have a, I think the word was Rooseveltian moment in 2008, and people who have been disappointed that that hasn't happened. Could you comment on, my mind is somewhat on what happened in New York over the weekend and what Governor Cuomo was able to accomplish, because we talked about that last hour of the show. But the New York Times reporter talked about the fact that he was able to make people's hearts sing with this legislation. No matter where you are politically, he really made a lot of people very, very happy. What can you address the current president, and why do you think that Rooseveltian moment just didn't happen and doesn't appear to be going to happen during the remainder of his presidency?
Well, after the 8 years of Bush and Cheney, many people read into Barack Obama their own hopes about the country.
Yeah.
They saw him in sharp relief to what had come before, and they probably, I think it's very likely that they greatly exaggerated his potential and the ability of any progressive president to make progress in a time that is so dominated by big money, big corporations, and big media. So I think many people read into Barack Obama more than we should have. We tied his performance up in our expectations. Secondly, I don't think we paid enough attention to the fact that his whole career has been built upon negotiating, conciliating, and collaborating as with white grandparents from Kansas and a black father from Kenya and a single mother living in Hawaii and Indonesia. He was really thrown into a fractured, fragmented world, and he, as a young black man, negotiated his way up in the political system. I think he read history very well and read the current very well, in that he did not want to appear to be an angry black man like Jesse Jackson, who was the first African-American after Shirley Chisholm to run for president and had come through the civil rights movement and was indignant that we hadn't made more progress, or an angry black man like Al Sharpton was at that time. So he deliberately and by nature, I think, cast himself in the role of a black man whom whites could trust, and that was a big factor. So by conciliation and cooperation and sometimes capitulation, he became a consensus builder. He also believed that he could turn the other cheek, consistent with the New Testament. And what he discovered when he got to be president is the enemy, if you turn the other cheek, the right wing would slap it. He believed too much in the goodness of the other side. He didn't understand sufficiently that politics is about power, particularly with the right wing. And they have taken him for a ride every time that he would hold his hand out in a gesture of conciliation. Bipartisanship, they would slap it away. And then he doesn't have what Teddy Roosevelt and Franklin Roosevelt had, the instincts of a fighter. He's a negotiator. He's a conciliator. He likes to speak, but he doesn't like to pressure. And the country needed someone who came out of those 8 years of Bush and Cheney, growing inequality, huge deficits, two wars that were unresolved, and would fight for a progressive alternative to what we'd had for 8 years. And he didn't. He's not an executive. He's a moderator. He would have been a great convener at the Aspen Institute, but he doesn't have the capacity to fight. He's disappointed his base. That's a cliche. But what he's really done is to disappoint the ordinary, everyday people of this country who needed a fighter to reverse who would say democracy's in trouble, oligarchy looms, the odds are against us, but we cannot give up. You know, he doesn't understand enough what Frederick Douglass reminded us, that power concedes nothing without a struggle. And Obama prefers to float above the battle instead of on the ground engaging it. He's a good man. He's a moral man. He's an intelligent man. But what the United States is, what ordinary people, what the middle class and working people need today is a champion and a fighter, and he's not that.
Ooh, Bill, you really thought about that long and hard. That was quite an answer.
Well, you know, of course, I've done all these interviews. I mean, I've thought about it all my life. I grew up under the regime of Franklin Roosevelt was the only president I knew for 11 years. I was born in 34. He died in 45. Harry Truman was a fighter. He stood up to the corporation, stood up to the reactionary forces, stood up to the segregationists. I mean, remember, the South walked out of Harry Truman's convention in 1948, and everybody said, he's finished because with a divided Democratic Party, he'll never win. But Harry Truman went out on the hustings, rode the train across America, roused the people, and he won. Lyndon Johnson fought for civil rights in 64 and 65, a flawed giant, but nonetheless a fighter. Yes, I've thought about it because I watched what was happening. Bill Clinton was like Barack Obama. Bill Clinton made his peace with the right wing. Doesn't seem that way. They impeached him, but that's a good example of how you give them an inch and they'll take a mile.
Bill Moyer is our guest this hour. Returning to your phone calls in a moment, we speak as his book has just been published, Bill Moyer's Journal, The Conversation Continues, a series of interviews. We have yet to talk about Jon Stewart. He starts the book, too. We agree. We both think he's the Mark Twain of our times. And we'll take more calls. 800-486-8655. This book consists of a series of interviews that he did on the Journal with people who are worth reading about and listening to because you think about what they have to say, which is a good thing. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to your phone calls, Karen in Richland Center. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you so much for taking my call. Mr. Moyer, I want to be the president of your fan club. How about that?
I'm not running, but I'm grateful for the nomination.
Listen, I've been listening to what you have to say, and I appreciate it, and I believe in it, and I agree with you. The issue that I have, the problem that I have with this is that it seems as though we do everything that we're supposed to do. We do everything that our Constitution allows us to do. We protest. We write letters. We sign petitions. We tell them again and again and again and yet again that we're not happy with their performance and we need for them to do something positive for us. And yet they don't listen and nothing happens. And I don't know what to do next. I work in a food co-op where I talk to a lot of people that come through the door, and we're talking peace-loving people, and they're talking violence. They're talking violence, taking guns and using... It's just horrible what I'm seeing and what I'm hearing. And so my question to you, Mr. Moyer, is what do we do? What can we possibly do? I don't know what to do next. We've done everything that we're supposed to do, and nothing is happening.
I understand, and that's exactly what I should have said to Marty from Milwaukee when he called a moment ago. What's different is people no longer – what's different from the past is that no longer people believe exactly what you just said, that it doesn't matter anymore, that they can turn a deaf ear and get away with it. Our political system is organized by incumbents for incumbents, and they're in the thrall of great wealth. You're exactly right about the fact that they don't listen. They pretend to listen. They don't care. They pretend to care. They don't. And there are people in this country. You know, I do not believe in violence. Never have believed in violence. And I would counsel against violence. But what we do need is a national movement. An uprising of, as you say, those people coming through the door of your co-op, peace-loving people. And if I had a blueprint for it, I'd give it away free. I don't. It started out there in Wisconsin when people without leaders just stood up and said, we can't do this anymore. They're taxing us, the working people, the public employees, to pay for what the millionaires and wealthy people aren't paying for. I don't have the answer to your question because we are at the moment that money rules our system. And as I said earlier, the only answer to organized money is organized people. And I don't know how we're going to bring enough people together across a continent. I mean, you can have mass gatherings in Cairo because it's the capital of a relatively small geographic country where people can congregate, and their gathering resonates throughout the country. You can do the same in Tunisia, the same in other of those smaller countries. But here we are, 3,000-mile continent with Washington, our capital, on one coast, far removed from people who cannot afford a bus ride to get there. So it's got to stay local. The fires have to be lighted locally, and they have to be sustained. We're not going to get an immediate reaction. But that has to become part of a national movement. You know, the Democratic Party is not the party of my youth. It no longer represents, there are good people in the Democratic Party, but it no longer represents the working men and women of this country. And the working men and women of this country must not be fooled by the propaganda coming from others. They must realize that they got to have a party of their own. And if they can't take over the Democratic Party, which is possible, if enough indignant Democrats organized in the primaries the way the Tea Party organized in the primary, then ordinary Americans could take the Democratic Party back. The Tea Party has become the nominating wing of the Republican Party, so that you cannot be a Republican candidate today without fulfilling your promises to your base, as irrational and wrong as they may be. If the working people of this country became the nominating party of the Democratic Party, it's possible to take it back. Not this year, not next year, and not perhaps in 2016, but you could, like the populists in the 1880s and the progressives in the early 1900s, set loose a movement that could one day be fulfilled in a president who comes to office determined that his first obligation is to the people who work for a living in this country, who understands that representative government, democracy, has to act as a brake on human greed and power, or we will live in a jungle where the strong take what they will and the weak take what is left. Organize, organize, organize.
Thank you, Karen, for your call. Matt in Lake Geneva, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Can't hear you very well, Matt.
Opportunity to talk to Bill Moyers, who I really admire. You talked about interviewing Howard Zinn,
mm-hmm.
and an anarchist. He didn't refer to himself as a progressive. He called himself an anarchist. And then I'm of your great interview in 2007 with Ron Paul, who's an anti-war, anti-corporate libertarian. So isn't there maybe a lesson here that we need to broaden our view a little bit and not get trapped by labels like progressive and maybe think a little outside of the box with the help of people like you? Thank you very much.
Thanks, Matt.
Hey, Matt, amen to that. Yes, absolutely. I think it's not a matter, as Jim Hightower says this in the book, it's not a matter of left or right. It's a matter of top and bottom. Jim Wright says that overweening corporations are running roughshod over the workaday people of the country. They think they're the top dogs and we're a bunch of fire hydrants. Well, the fire hydrants are left and right and unaffiliated. Most people don't have time to be left or right, don't have time to be liberal or conservative. They get up in the morning, go to the first of probably two jobs. They go through the day looking after the affairs of their family, the needs of their employer. They come home at night, they're tired. They don't have time to be a partisan. That's why what representative government is supposed to be. It's supposed to represent the best interest of those people, even though they don't have time to be full-time partisans. So, yes, this movement that I'm talking about is not a progressive movement per se. It's not a liberal movement per se. Like the Tea Party shouldn't be a Tea Party movement. There will be differences that divide us, like Ron Paul and I disagree on universal medical care. He's a doctor, I'm not, but we disagree on that. But we could agree that money should not be running America, and we could agree on enough of those things to create a movement. But you have to start where you are, and for people in this country who still think of themselves as Democrats, I say you've got to take over your party. And the Republicans did that. And then maybe you can have a nonpartisan, a bipartisan coalition. But you got to start with a political instrument. You have to have something in your hand that represents, that you can use. The right wing has the Republican Party. Working people, whether they are liberal or conservative, do not have a party at the moment.
Well, Bill Moyers, thank you very much for being with us, for your words, and thanks so much for doing the book.
Thank you, Kathleen, and thanks for the honor of giving me the honor of talking to some of your viewers. I'm sorry we didn't get to many more of them. We could do this all day.
I know we could. Easily we could do this all day. Thanks, Bill.
All right, thank you.
Bill Moyers, and the book, which has just been released, is Bill Moyers Journal. The conversation continues. It's a series of wonderful interviews. We didn't even get to talk about many of them. Karen Armstrong included, Robert Bly, Thomas Cahill. We haven't talked to him in a long time. Barbara Ehrenreich is in the book. Victor Gold, Nikki Giovanni, James Galbraith, and many others. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour and Chrissy Pease for on-air production in our downtown Milwaukee studios. And thanks for listening, everybody. I have a couple more furlough days, so I'll be with you again on the 4th of July. We'll celebrate. Stay tuned.